Hello, folks. My name is Kevin Spinelli, and I'm here with Mr. Paul Eli, who's generous enough to join us for a conversation on Flannery O'Connor's novel, her last novel, The Violent Barred Away. We're honored to have Mr. Eli with us. He's a senior fellow for the Center of Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University. He was a senior editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, the publishing house that published Flannery O'Connor, all of her works. He's also the author of a recent book, Reinventing Bach, that came out last year, and a very important book for what we're going to discuss today, The Life You Save May Be Your Own, which was a biography on four very influential Catholic writers in the 20th century, Flannery O'Connor, Dorothy Day, Merton, and Walker Percy. That came out in 2003. He also wrote an article for the New York Times, which I thought was excellent, wondering whether or not there are any Catholic writers, serious writers, Catholic writers of fiction. That came out in the New York Times book review back in December 2012. He was also the author of an essay called Love and Violence that's part of a collection entitled Not Less Than Everything, Catholic Writers on Heroes of Conscience. That came out earlier this year, 2013. And Mr. Eli will refer to this, his essay, Love and Violence, throughout our discussion today. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Eli.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. And I've not had a chance to talk about The Violent Barred Away at any length since my book was published almost 10 years ago. So thanks for the opportunity.
I want to start with the title and the epigraph. Flannery, it seems, begins with a synecdoche, a verse from Scripture that begs the person reflecting on her piece to go back and look at Scripture. And I just want to read a chunk of Matthew chapter 11 to begin. This is verse 7. When the messengers were on their way back, Jesus began to speak to the people about John. What was the spectacle that drew you to the wilderness? A reed bed swept by the wind? No. Then what did you go out to see? A man dressed in silks and satins? Surely you must look in palaces for that. But why did you go out to see a prophet? Yes, indeed, and far more than a prophet. He is the man of whom Scripture says, Here is my herald, whom I send on ahead of you, and he will prepare your way before you. I tell you this, never has there appeared on earth a mother's son greater than John the Baptist, and yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. Ever since the coming of John the Baptist, the kingdom of heaven has been subjected to violence, and violent men are seizing it. For all the prophets and the law foretold things to come until John appeared, and John is the destined Elijah, if you will but accept it. If you have ears, then hear. Mr. Eli, what's the connection between the title, this verse, and the novel that Flannery produced?
I think there are a few things to say about it. The first, and it possibly you know better than I do on this score, when I was working on The Life You Save May Be Your Own, I looked into the title, Violent Barred Away, and if I remember right, the Jerusalem Bible notes say that this is a particularly enigmatic passage of Matthew, and what it means is not really clear to biblical scholars, and how it's to be translated, it follows, is not especially clear, and that explains the pretty great variance between the translation you just read. The kingdom will be subject to violence, and violent men will
bear it away, are seizing it, excuse me.
And violent men are seizing it. And in, I think Flannery follows either the Douay or the Authorized Version, the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent bear it away. Now, given the attention that's been given to Scripture over the 20 centuries, that some passages remain so enigmatic is striking. And that was, I think, part of the attraction for O'Connor. She looked in all her work for images that weren't shop-worn, that had a raw power that couldn't be diminished by literal explanation. And here, as in the title of her first novel, Wisebud, she found an expression that has great power, even when you don't quite know what it means. the notion of what wise blood is in her first novel is difficult to figure out, even if you read the novel a number of times. Same here. She worked very hard on the book. It took her close to 10 years from 1952 when she finished Wise Blood up to middle of 1959 when she finished The Violent Bear It Away. Early in the process, she said, often a writer doesn't know where the next word is coming from. Well, I don't know where the next 60,000 are coming from. And those 60,000 were The Violent Bear It Away. She struggled to write it. She kept turning away from the novel to write short stories and described that process as like taking a vacation in the mountains, to be on vacation from her novel. When she went to Lourdes, a wealthy cousin had paid for a pilgrimage to Lourdes in the hope that O'Connor, who had a degenerative bone disease, lupus, might be healed there. But she wrote to friends saying, I prayed for my book, not my bones. And the book was The Violent Bear It Away. And then as she finished, she told a friend, I like the title more and more and the rest of it less and less. And leaving aside her tart appraisal of her own novel, it gives you the basis in an attraction for this title. She found an expression she really liked and then kind of worked away from that more than having a very, very definite idea of what it means. I don't think it's unfair to her to say that she just found a really good expression that captures the role of violence in real religion and tried to dramatize it.
It caught my eye, especially in the context of the last 6 months. It kept popping into my head with Newtown and then with the marathon bombings. The violent bear it away. I substitute the good away when I hear that phrase. How does Flannery use violence in this novel?
So for O'Connor, O'Connor worked out an aesthetic of the grotesque, as she called it. It came from Thomas Mann and some other writers. The grotesque is an image that's extreme and a bit repulsive that performs or brings about a certain effect in the work. And the effect, she had a lot to say about the effect of the grotesque, but the grotesque for O'Connor is the quickest way, shortest line between two points is a grotesque image or gesture. The grotesque can do the work of dozens of pages of literal writing. It's an extreme image that connects ideas that we might not associate with one another. So examples of the grotesque in her work, there's Hazel Mote's blinding himself with lie at the end of Wise Blood, or the fraudulent preacher in the story Good Country People detaching the wooden leg that Joy Holga, who has a PhD, is wearing and removing it from her. Or there's an image in a story called The Comforts of Home, and I'm not sure I want to give away the ending of the story, but it has to do with a telescope that's being pointed at the moon and the impression that this leaves on a child of a tender age. These are grotesque images that enable her to make a point very powerfully. She said, for the hard of hearing you shout, and for the almost blind you draw large and startling figures. And she liked to quote the expression from the New Testament, where when after Paul was knocked off his horse, he saw men and they looked like trees but walking. Or if that wasn't Paul, it was a blind man whose sight had been restored, I think in the gospel rather. But that kind of powerful image is what she was after. So put simply, the violence is grotesque action. It's an action that connects two points really dramatically and really economically and quickly. And so, first of all, that's what violence does in this novel. It enables her to connect her big themes of prophecy, of responsibility, of a vocation that is to be embraced or rejected, but not to be chosen over other than that, of the ways in which people who are joined to one another by blood accept that or deny it, of the radical incommensurability of different worldviews, and she uses violence to join those things.
I'd like to read a passage from toward the beginning of the book, page 5. The old man who said he was a prophet had raised the boy to expect the Lord's call himself and to be prepared for the day he would hear it. He had schooled him in the evils that befall prophets, and those that come from the world, which are trifling, and those that come from the Lord and burn the prophet clean. For he himself had been burned clean and burned clean again. He had learned by fire. Do you take this as literal? Is part of becoming a person close to God or authentic in faith, does God use pain, suffering as a purgative, as something that burns away what is trifling? Is this a claim or is this a trope or is this the Christian tradition? I mean, later on, Ray Burt, the school teacher, old Tarwater's nephew, says that the uncle, the old man, had sought to raise a prophet, namely the young Tarwater, the 14-year-old boy who was the main character of this novel, to burn Ray Bear's eyes clean. How does violence work in making, or is it false? Does violence work as an instrument of God's grace?
I think O'Connor would say certainly that, well, I don't want to say certainly. I think for her it has to do with how we understand the crucifixion. That to be a Christian is to bear a cross and to understand that it's a cross and to bear it willingly, even though it's a cross, and to know that the chance for an encounter with the Lord is past if that cross isn't borne. She used a phrase of Teilhard de Chardin's, passive diminishments. For her, it was lupus. It was the loss of a father. It was the sense that her own life would be short. It was the inability to travel as much as she'd like or to have an independent life away from her mother. These aren't violence in the sense of coal being touched to the face of a prophet or being burned clean, but they're analogous. I think they're of the same species with what you're talking about or what the imagery of violence suggests in the novel, that it's through these encounters with the ways which we're diminished that we are burned clean. And so O'Connor, the novelist, as I say, was drawn to the grotesque image, was drawn to the most vivid possible way of expressing this experience, which she would say is common to us all and occurs to some people, like Francis Tarwater, through literal violence, and to most of us through a more figurative act of diminishment like the one Teilhard described.
And there's a couple points when the boy, thinking about his call, says, and actively refusing the mission, the main mission that the uncle, the great uncle, gives to the boy, namely, bury me properly and baptize Bishop, his grandnephew. In the midst of the refusal, there's an image of Christ on the cross that the boy brings up from time to time. For instance, on page 91, this is the point where after the uncle dies and the boy makes his way to the school teacher uncle's house in the city, he sees Bishop and he has a revelation that indeed he is going to baptize the child, he will be a prophet, and his work as a prophet will not be remarkable. His black pupils, glassy and still, reflected depth on depth his own stricken image of himself, trudging into the distance in the bleeding, stinking, mad shadow of Jesus, until at last he received his reward, a broken fish, a multiplied loaf. It's a great, I mean, that's a fantastic image, and I think this has to be what I think you were talking about as far as the notion of cross, and what bookends the crucifixion is the multiplication of the loaves and the Eucharistic instances after the cross. And the boy rejects that. It is revolting to him.
It's a dangerous business to reduce O'Connor to theology, okay, Partly because I'm not a theologian, and partly because the point of the kind of fiction she wrote is that it's sufficient unto itself. But it's possible to talk about certain patterns that she favors again and again. Both of her novels are about people who are unable to do something that they'd want to do. And for these people, in O'Connor's eyes, their integrity consists in their not being able to do what they want to do, mainly shake off the sense of obligation to perform something, to do something that has the character of a divine command. In Wise Blood, Hazel Motes wants to get rid of Christ, the figure moving from tree to tree in the back of his mind. Here, Francis Tarwater is resentful of the fact that he's been given this charge by Old Man Tarwater to bury him properly and to baptize Bishop. And O'Connor found in these figures images of the human person in our time who would rather not have the heavy burden of the Christian inheritance with the sense of obligation that it produces, but tries to throw it off, but doesn't succeed in doing so and has a certain integrity in the failure to do so. So I'm not sure, let me try to wind that back around to your question. We can see it in the passage that you read. He's resentful of not only the burden that Old Man Tarwater has laid on him, but of the fact that he has to live his life in the shadow of Christ at all. And Raber resents this in the opposite direction. Raber would like to emancipate Francis Tarwater from this burden that he's got, the burden of Christianity that Old Man Tarwater has laid on the boy. And he would do it through testing and social science and modern psychology. And Francis would do it through boyish, stiff-necked refusal. The action of the novel, and it's a complex action, is for both of those attempts to throw off the yoke to fail, and for us to see Francis carrying out his duty in spite of himself and in spite of the school teacher. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah. Yes. But two questions follow from that, and I'm trying to understand. And thank you for helping me. There seems to be violence in the refusal on the part of Francis Tarwater, the boy. And there's many points. I can think of the time when they're checking into the hotel, and he says, well, I'll read it. He continued to look down at her. You can't just say no, he said. You got to do no. You got to show it. You got to show you mean it by doing it. You got to show you're not going to do one thing by doing another. You got to make an end of it one way or another.
Right. So doesn't that seem to ennoble a character who is akin to a terrorist, let's say? That O'Connor has chosen, and I can be all literary critical about her use of an economical image of violence to make her points. But when you read the novel, you say to yourself, this guy is burning down houses and drowning people, and he's our hero. And in some sense, his carrying out of these acts has a religious dimension that she approves of. This doesn't compute. Am I following your train of thought?
That's part of it. But what I'm getting at, does Flannery see a violence on the part of God forcing vocation on the uncle, on Raber, to a sense that he refuses, and on the boy? So is there like a double violence in this? There's violence in the refusal, and the consequence of that refusal, and it's an outright refusal, is concrete violence. Is there violence on God's part for God to create a circumstance in which the only way that the boy can really carve out an identity for himself apart from other individuals is violence? Is there sort of a fiendishness on the part of God in this sense?
Let me answer in two parts. The first part, my progressive theological tendencies want to say God doesn't act fiendishly in our tradition. The response to the call takes different forms, and we labor in a fallen world, and those things lead to circumstances like the one you described, where violence seems to be the only appropriate action. That said, certainly in the books, you feel that the violence is initiated by God at key points. The essay that I wrote about Caravaggio called Love and Violence was an attempt to explore this a bit, because in Caravaggio's work, you feel the intervention of God through acts of violence even more directly than you feel it in O'Connor's work. You know, in Caravaggio, when Paul is knocked off the horse, he practically breaks his neck. when Peter is crucified, he's upside down and he's an old man, and you can really feel the brittle bones of this man practically cracking under the weight of his own torso, let's say. And there are a number of other paintings which this is true. The essay begins, "God does not rape, God woos," Augustine said, "but the evidence of Caravaggio is that God would have it both ways." So here we have these two great Christian artists, Flannery O'Connor and Caravaggio, both choosing violence as a means of expressing God's agency. And it, given the events of the last 6 months, as you suggest, it's really disquieting and invites us to see what possibly we're missing in the current narratives and current events, and also to cast a cold eye on, say, this novel and say, maybe that kind of violence is a appropriate dramatic action, but she was all too accurate in her choice of characters, and truth is stranger than fiction now. I mean, we wouldn't want to be sitting here saying, well, those guys who bombed the Boston Marathon, there was an integrity in the dramatic way they resisted the claims of secular liberal culture through their violent act. But in effect, that's pretty close to the argument underpinning the violent Bear It Away, is it not?
Yes.
And this is what got you thinking about it in the first place, I guess.
Yes.
I'm not sure how to answer further than that, except to say that O'Connor's work was, attention came to it especially for its violence. In itself, and because a prematurely elderly-looking lady in librarian glasses was the author of these works of violence, and that she was a devout Catholic who was going around speaking at Catholic women's colleges about these stories, about grandmothers getting shot at the side of the road. But we can see now, I think, that the attention that she gave to violence is what makes her work especially pertinent in our time, when the work of, say, J.F. Powers or Peter Taylor or other writers from that time seems more locked in that time. Here we are talking about O'Connor because she grasped that these violent episodes were going to be episodes in which our culture was laid bare.
One of the things that I hear in Flannery and I hear in this novel, and I certainly heard it at the end of the novel, is, and I hear it even in the cold sentences of Thomas Aquinas and parts of, you know, Augustine, you get an argument for God and evil, or the relationship of that, if there is one. I hear Flannery sort of pounding her fist on the table and saying, and please help me understand this better, God works through sinners. God's providence cannot be thwarted. God can take your no and rectify it, sanctify it, and break something open in you that was better than or more complicated than what existed before. Because at the end of this novel, with all the violence and really the principal, well, one of the principal sources of violence in the boy, Francis Tarwater, though he committed much violence, the no turned into grace. A boy was baptized, a man was buried, he found a vocation. Does that make sense? Or am I sort of injecting far too much theological conceptual framework into this?
I think your way of putting it makes perfect sense in that it lines up with O'Connor's own exegesis of her work. The question for me is, would we understand the work that way if we didn't have the brilliant commentary she left in her letters and in the essays in Mystery and Manners that then becomes the material of books like mine, The Life You Saved May Be Your Own? I was emboldened to be a writer of a certain kind, less by O'Connor's fiction than by Mystery and Manners, where this person who explains so powerfully how fiction works and does it in a way that makes reference to our own tradition at all points made me see our tradition anew when I was about 20 years old and just realized that it went much deeper than I had understood. So I never, after that, had the chance to approach O'Connor innocently. I had her sense of things very strongly in mind as I went over her work again and again. So we're talking about the fiction very much in the terms that she chose. And I think knowing that she was going to die young, she took an extra effort to explain herself in the letters, in The Habit of Being, and in the talks in Mystery of Manners, that she knew that she wasn't going to be around to be on mic today. So she would have to put it in those letters for us to talk about. But to wind back around to the point I was trying to make, if you came to this novel cold without any sense of O'Connor as a devout Catholic, as a person who saw herself as trying to dramatize the spiritual quandaries of the modern age, a person who lived in Georgia and was a gradualist in race relations and so forth, wouldn't it be possible to say, you know, these people are all caricatures. Raber is a caricature of the secular liberal, and Old Man Tarwater is a caricature of the backwoods prophet, and Francis Tarwater is not too far away from Holden Caulfield and other teenage rebels. That, I think, is the question, whether just read as fiction, whether it communicates the things that we're quite legitimately talking about when we come to it from our religious tradition.
Thank you. I'd like to move on to the character of Raeburn. Just read a short passage. But not only could the, and what I'm going to say, not only could the uncle, the old man Tarwater, seem like a backwoods prophet, he might also be seen as sort of a Lacanian, somebody who's a, you know, sort of a French postmodern, because he rejects school. I remember somebody giving a lecture on Lacan and saying, look at you Americans. You guys in grammar school are indoctrinated in how to think. How? By making hand turkeys. By tracing your hands on papers as third graders. And what are they making you do? Stay in your seat, orderly, think about, you know, the history that they want to offer to you. So they're indoctrinating sort of type of a way of looking at your country, but not only that, a way of being a student, of sort of being in control of your body. And I just, there's a great passage, 16 and 17. This is the old man Tarwater talking to the boy and critiquing Raeburn and city life, regular, ordinary, professional life. I'm at the bottom of 16. The old man Tarwater says, I saved you to be free, your own self, he had shouted, and not a piece of information inside his head. That's Raeburn's head. If you were living with him, you'd be information right now. You'd be inside his head, and what's furthermore, he said, you'd be going to school. The boy grimaced. The old man had always impressed on him his good fortune in not being sent to school. The Lord had seen fit to guarantee the purity of his upbringing, to preserve him from the contamination, to preserve him from as his elect servant, trained by a prophet for prophecy, while other children his age were herded together in a room to cut out paper pumpkins under the direction of a woman. He was left free for the pursuit of wisdom. The companions of his spirit, Abel and Enoch and Noah and Job, Abraham and Moses, King David and Solomon and all the prophets, from Elijah who escaped death to John whose severed head struck terror from a dish. The boy knew that escaping school was the surest sign of his election. That's a great passage.
Well, it made a big impression on me because my wife and I homeschool our children. And you get all sorts of questions from people about what you're doing and why you're doing it. And you also hear a fair amount in the homeschooling community, it's not too far from this, that a lot of formal schooling is what's called socialization more than it's education. O'Connor was fairly traditional on matters of education in her remarks. You know, she said she would rather be teaching the young ones which end of the sentence to put the period on than teaching the older ones literature. And she was derisive about her own college experience and I think the higher level of high school, where they were studying sociology and the students were asked their opinions on everything. And she felt that the student's opinion was being formed and shouldn't be consulted as frequently as it was consulted in her experience. That said, it's a very powerful image here of how the kind of education that Raeburn has in mind is a form of indoctrination. It's easy to flip the novel in the other direction, though. And I mean, Raeburn is such an unattractive character that it's hard to take a side, and of course she wants to be just that way. But Raber sees Francis indoctrinated by Old Man Tarwater, indoctrinated with doctrine, Christian doctrine. Old Man Tarwater sees the prospect of Francis being indoctrinated with secular humanism. So it's a very balanced, structurally balanced book that way, with Francis in the middle and these two opposing forces. But O'Connor's so clearly on the side of Old Man Tarwater that Raber can't win an argument if he tries.
Another great passage talking about Raber. The boy Tarwater is trying to prompt Old Man Tarwater to tell him why the uncle Raber never came back after he was shot, of course. Never came back with the authorities and tried to get him out of the situation if he really cared for him. And the old man says, "You want to know why? Well, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you exactly why. It was because he found you a heap of trouble. He wanted it all in his head." And a great line, "You can't change a child's pants in your head." One of the things, and perhaps this is just, maybe Flannery's done this almost too clearly, is seems like the old man Tarwaters is crazy and violent, but he also loves. He seems to have loved the boy.
There's a great passage where it's in the mind of Francis Tarwater, and he says, you know, something to the effect of, the old man had his faults, but with him the boy certainly did eat well. Not a day did he awake without the smell of fat back frying.
Right.
And this, the domestic tenderness that the old man showed for Francis is really clear in the book, and it's really in line with what O'Connor's saying. She described the art of fiction as the art of putting list slippers on clerks. In other words, the concreteness of the fictional act is what she felt she had to insist on. Sensory detail, accurate speech, physical qualities of the characters and of their environment. And that's very close to her moral sense, which is that to live in our world incarnated is to live in a world of the body and of other people. And modernity wants to escape that theoretically. This was part of her confusing and unsatisfying to me defense of the separation of the races in the South. She basically didn't think the races should be separated based on pure reason. Her view was that in the South, although they were supposedly separated, whites and blacks, in fact, lived together more than they did in the North, mm-hmm. where there was actual integration. And that a lot of Northern liberals, like Raber, came down with their theories of how things should be, whereas Southerners, who were morally inferior from the point of view of the North, actually Southern whites and blacks lived together and dealt with one another in a way that you didn't see elsewhere. I'm taking a detour from the point just to emphasize how important it was to her, the actual concrete acts of what she called compassion, suffering with, people suffering with each other.
Yeah, and it just strikes me, what you were talking about is, you know, in the context of Boston, after busing in the early 70s and now there's far much more segregation in the Boston City schools than there ever was. And it's sort of looking at such a complicated thing as race and how groups within a city or a community interact with one another is much more complicated than simply setting an educational policy. You know, it's far more complicated.
Right, and in that way she set herself against the theorists, and Raber is, there are a couple of representatives of theorists in her short fiction in that story, The Comforts of Home, and a couple of others, but Raber is the arch theorist, this person who's extremely abstract, has ideas that come out of books. He's impatient with actual existing humans. When he's with Tarwater, after the first day, he knows it's just a matter of endurance to take care of the boy for much longer than that. And so a lot of her resentment or her contempt for what she called intellectuals and theorists is worked into the character of Raber.
Hmm. And one of the scariest things about Raber is what he says about love. or what he thinks about love. There's a whole passage, pages 113 through about 117. This is on pages 113, 114. He's talking about the love that overcomes him when sometimes he interacts with Bishop. This just overwhelms him. And a couple times, Flannery uses the notion of an undertow. And I think that's a brilliant image for true love, or love you can't control. It's sort of a forceful undertow. It was not the kind that could be used, talking about love that he felt. It was not the kind that could be used for the child's improvement or his own. It was love without reason. Love for something futureless. Love that appeared to exist only to be itself, imperious and all-demanding. The kind that would cause him to make a fool of himself in an instant. And it only began with Bishop. It began with Bishop, and then, like an avalanche, it covered everything his reason hated. He always felt with it a rush of longing to have the old man's, that's the great uncle's, eyes, insane, fish-colored, violent with their impossible vision of a world transfigured, turned on him again. The longing was like an undertow in his blood, dragging him backwards to what he knew to be madness. That's a fantastic passage.
So, and it is, and in this sense, for O'Connor, and I think in the Catholic and the Christian tradition, love and violence are akin. The essay that I wrote about Caravaggio is called Love and Violence, and the point I was trying to bring out is that if you reflect on Caravaggio's art or Flannery O'Connor's, your two poles are not orthodoxy and heterodoxy, or faith and doubt, sin and redemption, so much as love and violence. Love, and I hope this makes sense, in O'Connor's economy, love is grotesque in that it's the shortest line between two points. It's an extreme reaction that joins things that often don't go together. And that's precisely what Raber finds so frightening about it. The rational mind doesn't want this force that doesn't have limits, that goes out of bounds. And by reflecting on the way in which love is like violence in O'Connor's work, I think we can learn a little something in a non-sappy way about what her account of love is. That it goes where it's not supposed to go, it takes people out of themselves, it produces conclusions that nobody could have expected, it joins people to people others that they might not have expected to be joined to in any real way. It makes claims that can't be shaken off, even when there are plenty of good arguments for shaking them off. These things are true of love, and they're dramatized in many instances in O'Connor through acts of violence. But to answer your question of almost half an hour ago, that's one of the roles that violence plays in her work, is to illuminate love by this strange unlikeness of violence and love.
And how you just depicted love, is that how God loves? Does God love us who are so unsymmetrical, dissimilar to God's self? I mean, or are we just talking about human love? Is there an analogy that might be underpinning what Flannery is trying to tell us about what happens between human beings or within human feelings of religious experience or within families? Is that how God loves?
So our tradition confidently declares that God's love doesn't have limits, and that God's love will seek us out, and that to respond to that love is to go on an adventure that you don't know quite where it's going to wind up. In that sense, it is akin to violence. I think the question that a modern person has to ask is, well, we can see the force of violence very clearly. Someone puts a bomb near a marathon finish line and people are dead. You Christians are talking about the force of God's love all the time, but where is the evidence of that force? It feels very rhetorical. And then my question, as someone asking as a Catholic, I say, well, was that kind of love more directly felt or more evident in prior ages, and that we lack the habits of mind to feel it, or the habits of attention, or was it as rare in Caravaggio's time as it is now? And it's hard to recognize, so it took an artist as bold as Caravaggio to dramatize it. I don't have an answer here. I'm just letting you know what I would try to work out for myself. The effects of violence are everywhere. Where are the effects of God's love if these two things really do correspond?
At the end of the novel, and I think this is another thing I see, and another thing that when I try to make sense of what we're just talking about, and throughout this book, people are saved or are trying to save others, I think it is absolutely, at its core, Catholic to realize that my salvation occurs with your salvation. It is somehow granted communally. And in the last realization that Tarwater has at the end of this novel, he sees before him a community where his uncle is and has some sense that he anticipates himself as part of that community and work the rest of his life in the anticipation of that. Now, is there some sense that although there is concrete acts of violence and concrete consequences of those acts, there is a community that's aware of itself that can encompass that violence and therefore somehow, if not make sense of it, mitigate it?
I think so. And I hope the answer I'm about to give connects up with the novel as much as you'd like. The poor will always be with us. We have that from Scripture. Violence will always be with us. There's no prospect of a world without violence. It's just a fact. So either we're going to have communities that can somehow absorb that violence or not. Now, another of the figures in the story I tell in The Life You Say May Be Your Own is Dorothy Day. And her religious adventure and the book begins with the San Francisco earthquake. There's an earthquake in San Francisco, buildings fall, and for the next 10 days or so, she said, people loved one another. They treated strangers like family. This was the inspiration for The Catholic Worker. In effect, Dorothy Day said, why do we need an earthquake, in the idiom of the time, to recognize that all men are brothers? Why can't we act all the time the way we would act when, in this case, natural violence of an earthquake occurs? So to move forward to our own time, why do we need 26 kids, 26 people killed in Newtown to recognize that great acts of mercy and things of wonder are taking place in ordinary public schools on a daily basis? Why do we have to have an elementary school teacher be dead before credit is due or attention is paid to those people? I think we see what's best in our society brought out in response to these acts of violence. And then the question that, let's say, mindful of both Flannery O'Connor and Dorothy Day, I would ask is, why does it always have to happen on the back end of those acts? Why can't the presence of violence, which is not going to go away, embolden us to form the communities that you're implying will enable us to withstand it, and that we can see enabling Tarwater to move forward in the novel?
Yeah, why do we have to be triggered to do acts of mercy? Mr. Eli, any last words or questions? I mean, I truthfully, sincerely thank you for helping me to understand this novel better. Thank you for helping me understand Flannery O'Connor better. I'm sure those who listen to this podcast will also be deeply grateful to you for helping us know this book better and be affected by it, because I'm deeply affected by the novel. But please, anything you want to add?
So the novel wasn't especially well received when it came out, and it's easy for us to forget that. Flannery O'Connor is now a canonical figure. This book was dismissed as kind of inhuman and full of caricatures in the New York Times. It sold a couple of thousand copies. The Time review of the book mentioned O'Connor's lupus more than it mentioned, in her view, more than it mentioned the book itself. In a sense, it was the end of a certain movement in her fiction. She said she didn't know where the next 60,000 were coming from, 60,000 words, this book. And after it, she wrote to one of the editors of America, I believe his name was Hoodie McCown. He was a Jesuit literary editor of America. She said to him, "I have a sense of having exhausted my original potentiality," or whatever. So what she did after this book was go to the source in a different way, especially through a reconsideration of Hawthorne. There's a little bit of Hawthorne in this book. Raeber is a little bit like the character in The Birthmark who sees his wife as defective because she has a birthmark. And there's a passage that I don't have at hand that is directly, you can just hear Hawthorne in it. But she went deeper into Hawthorne and tried to create a pattern of fiction based on what Hawthorne called the romance that was a little freer and enabled her to move through her themes with a lighter touch and more fleetly. And that's the work in her second book of stories, or many of the stories, Parker's Back, Revelation, Judgment Day, Everything That Rises Must Converge. So this book, who could have known that it would be her last novel? Only O'Connor, I think, fully expected that she might die at 38 or 39 years old. But there is a sense of it as a late work in the sense that she left this kind of fiction behind and turned toward the romance tradition in the fiction that she wrote afterward.
Mr. Eli, one more question. Do you have any sense of how Flannery prayed? What her spiritual practice was, or...
She went to daily mass. She read Aquinas every night. And she said that she would read just a little bit but get really absorbed, so that if her mother would come in and say she was going to turn off the light, she would say back, "I beg to differ and I must correct you that light, being eternal, cannot be turned off." And she did a kind of mock Aquinas answer to her mother. She was very taken with a prayer that was sent to her on one of the Catholic workers' Christmas cards, something about the angels of happy meeting. It's in the book, my first book, and she spoke very humbly of herself as a person who didn't have a deep spiritual life and wasn't a mystic, etc. But obviously, daily mass, a lot of spiritual reading, the prayers of a sick person, and prayers such as the Catholic worker prayer that she took advantage of suggests that there's more there than she let on.
Her fiction has affected my prayer. I'm sure it's affected yours. And I think it's made me a better Christian.
There's a book out which is a book of prayers that are drawn from the text of Flannery O'Connor. Do you know the book?
No, I don't.
Well, it's done by Angela O'Donnell from Fordham. So it has a week of prayers, you know, like morning prayer, midday prayer, and all the texts are taken from O'Connor's letters and stories and essays, and it's very, very well done. And look it up, because you can see how the right words, slightly recontextualized, are good, hard-headed devotional texts.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Eli. I really appreciate your time, your generosity to the book club today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me as a guest.